I first visited my grandmother's sister in North Friesland, a German lowland region protected by dikes in the North Sea, on the BYU Travel Study Program, Our European Ancestors. I've returned 11 times since then, most recently to research the life of Etta Ferryman, or Ferryman, who appears in the historical record for the first time in 1531, 31 years after the diking of Hochstetter Neuekoog, or Hochstetter Neupolder, where he owned land. Since I descend from each of his two sons, I'm both Etta's 10th and 12th great-granddaughter. Before parish registers, most local records derive from land ownership, primarily by men. So it's not surprising that existing records tie Etta to only two children, my ancestors, Hans and Folkart. Still, I picture another child, a slim blonde girl who once sat spinning wool under the reed thatch of the ferryman's farmhouse, melted wax for candles in a black clay pot from Jutland, and waded into the sea to step on smooth brown flatfish with red-orange spots. Since it is actually likely that my ferryman had more children than the record suggests, both sons and daughters, the daughter, I imagine, may have a basis in fact. I've named her Sibrick. What follows in 10 sections includes both historical fiction and memoir. I begin in the present with a recurring dream. Dream and Variations, Salt Lake City. Once, maybe twice a year, as darkness drapes the upstairs bedroom in my hillside home, I dream of tidal waves. Usually, I cross into wakefulness before the waves can hit. Then, in shadowed safety, and until they fade, replay the images. Stirred by my whirring ceiling fan, cool gusts of air wash over me. I pull up my faded comforter while the city, carved into the desert valley that surrounds me, sleeps. My hill is the hem of a mountain that once sloped up to and beyond the shoreline of Lake Bonneville, massive predecessor to the Great Salt Lake. Eons have passed since waters rolled above my lot, since my garden was lakebed sand. My brother Carl, formerly my foster brother, came to us through a cousin of my mother's cousin when we were both two. After I lost him to a car crash in 1996, I dreamed we were swimming when a great wave threatened. We dived beneath it, the trick we'd learned as children who loved shooting out the other side at Huntington Beach, less than an hour down Beach Boulevard from our suburban LA home. Neighborhood mothers shared station wagons on hot summer days, packed up picnics and children, and transported their cargo to the coast. In my dream, I slowly fought my way upward through deep water to the air. Carl never surfaced. After the wave passed in another dream, his daughter and her sons had vanished. Tolkien thought such dreams linked him to Lost Lyonnais, the fabled sunken land off the coast of Cornwall. Jung posited the dreamer feared overwhelming emotion. I once supposed my own dreams resulted from body surfing off Huntington, Newport, and Laguna beaches. Now I wonder if Tolkien and Jung have something to teach me about the lingering depths of loss, the tides of recompense. Breadcrumbs, April 11th, 1531. In the small Frisian port of Husum, on the southern coast of Denmark, four landholders, one also a ferryman, listen to a notary read a contract of pledge. The document has been carefully prepared. With a quill dipped into ink mixed with sea wormwood to keep away mice, the notary decorated the first letter of the first phrase, extending it more than halfway down the margin. Next, he set out the terms of the contract, long line after long line of diminutive script, in which, for a loan of 30 Lübeck marks, Lorenz Brodersen gives Dreves Olsen the use of 2.5 acres in Nykook, the newly diked holder. To hasten the ink's drying, the notary sprinkled the page with fine sand, which he later gently retrieved. The landholders have gathered, almost certainly, in the Olsen home. Dreves is acting as a private lender, and none of them can read, especially not the middle-low German used for such transactions. When the notary finishes reading the contract, he gestures to three moles of hardened beeswax holding gray-green wax. Lauren signals his agreement to the terms by sinking his seal into the first soft circle. Etta Jonsson, the first witness to the transaction, imprints his seal into the second. The ferryman makes the final gray-green impression, his house mark, a cross attached to a backward Z, ringed by the letters of his name. The ferryman is leaving me, a lineal descendant through each of two sons of Breadcrumb Trail, the best preserved of the embossed emblems and the contract they ratify. Both record his name, Etta Fairmans. The final S suggests his father, too, was a ferryman, that Etta is the son of Fairmon. The small, tan rectangle of costly vellum dangling its three wax seals is the earliest surviving relic of his life. 3. Sailing home, later the same day. I can see him now as he walks away from the moneylender's house and takes the first street to the harbor. He hears the clamor of tools, coughs on dust as he passes the glazier's workshop. He winks at the furrier's young wife, who has looked up from lining a hat, exchanges greetings with the rope maker, pauses to observe the casting of the church bell he will soon ferry to the large island across the heath. The morning sun lingers on his flaxen hair and blue-gray eyes, on the smooth, russet-colored leather of a close-fitting coat, on the belt's silver buckle. Two women selling butter and eggs admire the teal breeches over yellow stockings, the neat brown clogs. At his side is the small girl who had been sitting on a barrel by the moneylender's front door, waiting in the crisp spring air. She has white blonde braids and eyes bluer than his. Her white apron covers a skirt cut from the same wool as her father's breeches. When the pair reach the sluice separating the inner harbor from the little river Hoosum, they are joined by two flaxen-haired boys in their early teens, each wearing a new pair of wooden clogs. A trip to town is a rare outing for these folk from the Mirsch, but their business is ended, and they feel impatient to set sail for home. The boys help Etta raise the rigging, but he alone eases the flat-bottomed vessel through the large gates of the sea sluice, then out into the windy butter channel. Propelled by its powerful current, the boat sails north, gliding up the arm of sea separating the rich island parishes from the mainland. The musty smell of the moneylender's home and the cellar-like cramp of the shop are forgotten in the bracing sea air. The brick bell tower of Schogel's little church by the sea, on the coastline's only knoll, waxes steadily larger as they approach, wanes as they leave it behind. A chorus of quacking and cackling emits from nearby salt meadows, refuge in April for the noisy mallards and gray-legged geese that roost and fatten in them before flying on. The boat soon passes several clay-covered dunes and longhouses. Inland, at the heart of Haast Village, St. Marian's bell tower catches the sun, a mariner's landmark. The boat sails onward up the dike line of the Mirsch. Feeling an increasing bite in the wind, the ferryman and his young passengers look forward to the fired stove at the ferry house. 4. Time travel. July 27, 2011, just last week. In the fields behind Sterdebul, cows bellow as I lock the door at my holiday flat and walk to the horse corral. The farm here once belonged to my family. And leaning on the fence, I can see three other thatched houses and another with a tiled roof, all linked to me through an interwoven web of family ties. Grass covers the footpath that once led across these fields, so I leave the farmstead by the narrow asphalt road, walking at its side to the hamlet's endmost longhouse, also part of that overarching complex web. I cross to a set of concrete stairs and climb them to the crest of an inland dike, the main sea dike until the creation in 1987 of a new polder and sea dike to the west. Inhaling the cool, spicy scent of the Wadden Sea, the shallow but treacherous band of North Sea that lines this coast, I walk north at a pace that allows me to step around frequent piles of dung. As I approach, clumps of mothers and lambs lope off down the long slope into the nature sanctuary below. Only an occasional white butterfly floats by, the purple thistles they love having recently been cut back. In 20 minutes, I'm above and across from the rebuilt cottage of the Yalestrom sluice keeper. I stop to study it. Its upper flat now runs as a popular holiday home. then resume walking and soon overtake the small brick sluice house. On the opposite side of the road, a larger pump house drains low-lying fields to the east. Now my real work begins. In place of the inland dike on which I'm standing, I picture a smaller, wood-edged sea dike. Beneath me, replacing the metal grills in the tunnel below the dike, I picture tall oak gates that swing open when the tide streams out, shut when it races back in. For a ferry house, I fit a smaller version of the former sluice keeper's cottage with an extra alcove bed or two and restore its license to serve drink. For a ferry boat, I picture the 400-year-old wreck in the museum basement blended with a ferry painted by a Dutch little master. To give it passage to the sea, I replace the reed beds and lake in the nature sanctuary with the fast-flowing current of the old deep, a tideway into the Wadden Sea. I see the boat there now, lifted by the incoming tide, hoisting its sails to the wind. Finally, I imagine, reclaiming the nature sanctuary with runners of quickly advancing surf, the Wadden Sea. Roused by the wind, by the moon, a maniac bent on taking back land, on taking lives, hundreds, thousands of lives. Asleep, a band of pressed foil, a ribbon unfurled between islands and coast on the North Sea's southeastern rim, a luminous hem nearly 300 miles long and a few miles wide, edging land from Ho Bay in southern Denmark to Den Helder in northern Holland. I pause, try to conjure the entire scene at once. Suddenly, the centuries separating Edda from me vanish. A red fox, trotting southward on the land side of the dike, carries in its mouth a limp brown hare. Arctic terns and black-headed gulls circle over the mudflats. A cormorant dies into the sea. 5. Seven Sleepers Day, June 27, 1532, the year after Edda acted as witness to the Nykrug Loh. Edda leads Hans and Volkard west along Sterdebel's footpath, raising its dust. At the hamlet's edge, he climbs the timber stairs to a palisade dike, pausing to marvel anew at the contrast between wheat fields and hamlets to the east and glistening wetlands to the west. His sons in tow, he sets off toward the sea dike's new extension, turns northwest, and continues on in the direction of the sluice. The trio could make faster time along the path at the bottom, but the promise of a view draws Edda to the top. At the sound of the trio's footsteps, blue butterflies clinging to thistles lift upward on white-fringed wings. Marsh rosemaries and sea asters form clusters of lavender in the salt meadows below. In the distance, across the expanse of exposed seabed, Edda hears the persistent hissing of the incoming tide, certain now to gain steady momentum. He scans the seafloor. Nearest to the dike's wood border, lugworm mounds dud hard-packed sand. Puddles, the shining faces of densely strewn mirrors, glaze it. In those mirrors gleams the sky's shifting palette, wide strokes of blue adjoining the whites of clouds, dollops of gray and mauve abutting silver. Under the reflections mingle the starfish and crabs, blue mussels and shrimp that arrived with the morning tide and stayed on in the puddles. Oyster catchers wade in the pool's salt water, feasting on cockles and lugworms. In a tideway where gray herons dine on fish, two women are pushing long-handled nets. Edda recognizes them as the elderly wives of local fishermen, thinks they need to hurry. He gives a shout. When they look up, he points in the direction of the hissing to his air already doubled in volume, thinks one can never be too careful. He has heard the pastor's sermons, knows the mudflats here were once as fertile and habitable as the mainland. Farmsteads crisscrossed the acres, brick houses spilled over with families and their servants. The trading center of Rungholz lined ample pockets with gold. But the people ceased to acknowledge the Almighty's role in their good fortune. One day, God's anger erupted in an epic storm surge. In a matter of hours, the West Sea traded pastures, villages, and port for a spacious swath of the heath, by turns a coastal wetland and a shallow sea. When Edda trudges home after a night's ferry run, especially when the white mist settles on the landscape like a shroud, he swears he can see the ghosts of those who drowned. At such moments, he crosses himself and quickens his pace. Tomorrow, he'll have another story to tell about the mudflat ghosts, sinners drowned for their pride and rank in gratitude. Could such a tragedy happen again, ask his neighbors as they set down their ale, his passengers as they duck the spray from a wave? Surely not, he replies. We're at St. Marian's every Sunday. He wonders why they look at him uncertainly, eye his silver buckle, cross themselves. He considers his neighbors, thinks, so now I'm a rich islander? He eyes his passengers, thinks, you're the ones with oversized farms and enough coins for my fare. He knows the danger here is real, palpable, but in the wake of the old catastrophe, amid the ongoing fluctuation of the tides, one constant makes all the difference. Both of the heath's wide faces, flooded and not, are veined by channels, deep, winding furrows dug into the seabed by the tides. When twice each day the sea retreats, these sinuous pathways are easily seen. Closer to shore, fisherfolk dredge them with their nets, and sheep approach in search of glasswort. When the hissing increases to a roar and the channels drop beneath the flood tide, their borders remain staked with tall, young trunks of birch or pine, stripped of branches but topped by a fan of twigs. Etta and his fellow mariners anchor the sapling markers into the seabed and replace them as needed. Rising above the surface of the sea, they signal the safety of deeper water. Even so, Etta never forgets the hazards that lie in wait. Disorienting fog, sudden storms, troughs from tidal overfalls, unstoppable tides. For him, the channels are wrinkles of watercourse linking mainland to island, open sea to shoal. Saltwater highways, conduits, go-betweens, river-like tideways, but along their powerful currents, only the skilled dare navigate. Etta takes pride in the skillful piloting of his ferry, flushes even thinking of the vessel with the smooth, flat-bottomed hull. Named Sea Arn after the white-tailed sea eagle, whose range includes Meerschaum and coast. He can see her now, resting outside the open gates of the dike sluice. With a practiced eye, he gauges the depth reached by the tide returning to the nearby mudflats, sees it is already knee-deep, thinks no time to waste. He calls back to his boys to hurry. Minutes later, they arrive at the landing. With his son's help, Etta rocks the boat to one side and transfers onto the deck the cargo collected on the small dock. Casks of Sterdebel's prized water, several bales, two piglets, three sheep. His brother Kettle has had his hands full, is anxious now to let Etta take over. Four passengers are also waiting on the dock, one with a shepherd dog. Etta extends planks to the foreshore and helps them board, then heads to the ferry house with Kettle. With smiles all around, Etta greets several more passengers and escorts them back, winking at his boys. The boat will be full to capacity this afternoon, so full, in fact, Hans and Folkard will need to stay behind. They wink at each other. Finally, everyone is settled, and the boat eases forward against the current of the old deep, at 6 or 7 knots, too strong for even a good swimmer. Etta leans back and directs his gaze past the sails, again appraising the sunny sky and safe east wind. Confident at last of a smooth voyage and of the 7 fine weeks promised by fair skies on Samhain Sleeper Day, he turns back to face the receding shore where his boys are following the boat's progress toward the Botter Channel. The sea this afternoon lies still and inviting, warmed by late June's abundant welcome light. Etta cannot see the young girl, framed by that light, who is waving toward shore from the ferry's crowded bow. But Hans notices her and nudges Folkard. They return her wave. How did she get by us this time? Asks Hans. Was she here when we arrived, crouching between fishing boats? She's holding her clogs, Folkard says. She must have taken them off and run across the fields to catch up. You can see she's panting. When we weren't looking and Far's back was turned, she must have climbed into the boat. As the boys watch, their sister pivots toward the prow. Swiftly, however she managed to get aboard, the ferry boat is carrying her to the Morsoon sluice. 6. The Ferryman's Daughter. Without taking her eyes off the approaching shoreline, Sibrick lifts the hem of the teal skirt her mother wove last winter and slips into her clogs, thinks, Mem will chide me for the grass stains on my stockings, will tell me how the house seemed empty without her bright-eyed girl, the hours wearing without my helping hands. She shakes herself, thinks, that will be later, not now. She threads her way to where her father stands, smoking thyme in a clay pipe, free hand on the tiller. She waits for him to notice her. When he does, she returns the slow grin that spreads across his face. He has told her. She reminds him of herself, his self at her age, the boy who gazed at the horizon, imagining tall ships and far-off shores. She wonders if he wishes the boys were more like she is, more like himself. You can't stay with me, Sibrick, Ed says. You know that. If you insist on coming along, then you must leave me to my work. Yes, Far, I know. She darts to an empty space beside the rail. From here, she can see it all. The miles expanse of seawater, the sweep of the sky, the sheep and cattle on mainland and island dikes. For a while, she forgets about feeding her mother's geese and chickens, sweeping the cobblestone floor, gathering dried sheep dung for the fire, helping with the bread and frail Anka, her baby sister. She forgets the storms, the cold of what had seemed a never-ending winter. It's here she feels most at home, gliding across to Strome on her father's ferry. She wishes Hans and Volkart had come along. Together, they could study the eddies at sapling markers, observe the movement of the tide. The boys could explain why the twigs atop some markers point up while the others point down. Her brothers understand such things. But even with a trip to Morsum in time for tomorrow's market, she knows they were glad the boat is full, happy to walk back to herd the cows. Sibrick is sure, isn't the family's only taskmaster. Tonight, the ferryman and his daughter will sleep in the Morsum ferry house. In the morning, Sibrick will tag after him as he chats and laughs with the cartwright, the miller, the new young schoolmaster. She'll watch as her father slips coins to an old widow and shares a jest with farm wives who present him with eggs, gooseberries, a carrot or two. She chuckles, reaches over to pet the shepherd dog. Soon, she'll be knocking at the door of the Morsum ferryman, asking for her friend Marika, then chasing her along the pathways between wood cottages and workshops, brick homes and longhouses, up and down the earthworks and old dikes on which the village rests. When they stop to weave a clover chain and watch lambs romping through the grass, Sibrick will tell Marika about the five kittens she found sheltered under hay. Later, the girls will run across the meadows pretending to be horses. The winter had been especially harsh. The sea transformed too often into a ravenous ogre threatening their lives. Sibrick has heard her father's stories. Who hasn't? How the sea pours over dikes to devour houses and cottages, families and livestock, churches and mills. How the trading center of Rungholt lies at the bottom of the sea. How, when floodwaters recede, ships lie smashed on harbor streets or in soggy, ruined remnants of a favorite pasture. How the stench lingers for months, or for a lifetime, in survivors' dreams. How to this day the mudflats are haunted by the ghosts of the drowned. Who wouldn't be frightened then, when the wind pounded their farmhouse on a pitch-black night, when the roof seemed it would fly apart? She knew on those nights where her mother would be, sitting by the crack in the shuttered window, peering toward the dike, as though their longhouse didn't rest on a clay-covered dune, the highest in Stergal. On such nights, Sibrick goes to her mother and reminds her that floodwater would encircle them but spare their home. Then she carries Anka to her brother's alcove bed, climbs in and huddles with them under feather blankets, covering her ears. Her father is keeping watch with others along the dike, each lookout praying it will hold. So even on the hamlet's highest earthwork, how can an 8-year-old girl not be afraid? There is no fear today, however. Nothing but afternoon sun and the calls of the seabirds and the shine on the water. Lazily, the sea is stretching itself out, flat, shimmering, beckoning. 7. On the 16th century storms of the North Sea. The storms of the North Sea are legendary. The tide height and wind speed, the death toll for humans and livestock, the swallowing of villages, towns, and parishes on surrounding coasts. Written records from survivors, weather diaries, ship's observations confirm the horror. 55 times in 16th century North Friesland alone, twice in some years and across all seasons, the rustle of coastal breezes yielded to blasts that swelled and piled the waters of the Wadensee into powerful Sturmfluten. One arrived with the Neaptide on November 2, 1532, and ranked with the great storm surges to strike Schleswig-Holstein from the 15th through the 18th centuries. Storm winds lashed most of the North Sea coast. Coasts flooded from Denmark south to the Netherlands and Flanders. Dikes broke. Islands in the Netherlands sank beneath the waves. In North Friesland, winds from the feared northwest, likely veering west and back in the murderous configuration bringing the highest water, ravaged the coast. The disaster is recalled as one of four Allerheiligenfluten, All Saints floods, that occurred that century. 8. Aftermath. Early December, after the All Saints storm surge of November 2, 1532. Mem has wakened again in tears, and Far is cursing. Soon Anka will be crying too. Hans lies next to his brother in the darkness, the images flashing before his mind. The ungodly winds of the storm surge, the violent sea, the breach in the dike. The flood that followed, and the haunting scenes of his own dreams. Sibrik's small body, carried off in the powerful waves, tossed up, slammed down, lifted again and somersaulted, pitched side to side in a pattern of figure eights. Bloated when they found it, the purple neck swiveled backwards like a short-eared owl's. Now sunk in Udemem's grave, lying there with the stillborn twins, with baby Elin, and with Peter, the younger brother dead 3 years ago of fever. Her lamb, he whispers to himself, to Folkard. She wouldn't leave it, in the field. Should have stopped her. Should have been there. Our sister. 9. On the lingering depths of loss, the tides of recompense. July 8, 2009. In a cottage on an inland dike on Nordstrand, the largest surviving part of Strand, Kerstin practiced the art of cranial sacral therapy, works to release emotions linked with long-standing pain with stubborn injuries. My spirit warms to the yellow of her treatment room. My whiplash responds to her gentle touch, and slowly, with her fingers quiet at its nape, my neck begins to move, drawn as by a magnet, by puppet strings, side to side in figure eights, forward, backward, up, down. Unwinding, they call it. Therapeutic, they say. Freeing, I already know. In shy English, Kerstin asks, "Where are you now?" The question startles me. I keep my eyes closed as I reply. I was thinking about this dike underwater, picturing the blue-gray waves that washed it, recalling the relentless floods that inundated and shrank the island. In 1634, 15,000 dead, Strand cut into pieces and more soon gone, the second great drowning of men. In 1362, 100,000 swept to their deaths, Rungholt submerged, and 50 parishes lost, if the chronicles are right, in the first great drowning. When the session ends, Kirsten tells me, just before she asked me where I was, while I was observing the view from under undulating swells that billowed, folded upon themselves, pushed upward on higher, brighter, more transparent layers, she felt she was choking, gasping for air. She grips her throat with both hands, amidst a series of coughs, as though immersed, trapped, underwater. July 20th, 2009. I drive across the causeway formed by the Nordstrander Dam, sea to my left, until I reach the island and the road leads inland. At the orange bike advertising bicycle rental, I turn onto the road atop the old east dike and continue past the bakery to the brick cottage with a rose trellis. I park the Mini Cooper on a dirt parking strip across from the cottage. Kirsten welcomes my knock and ushers me in. "I have a question for you," I say. "When you felt you were choking and I was imagining floodwater, what do you think it meant? That my ancestors drowned here? That memories are inherited?" We were sitting across from each other, a small, low table between us. I'd read about possible cellular memory, had friends who would swear by it. Perhaps such a phenomenon could explain the dovetailing of our imaginings. One ancestor lived on the part of the island that split off. Another took his ferry boat to Old Morsum. I looked straight at her. "Or do you think it was me? My neck hurt, even as a child." Kirsten lowered her head. The wind whistled above the windows. I added, "I dream of tidal waves." Timidly, Kirsten lifted and cocked her head. The words came softly. "The latter, I think." Had she mined the core of passion on the old island of Strand? Had the wind carried the cries of the mudflat ghosts across its wide fields? Had one spirit, belt buckle glinting softly in the evening light, found his way here with a story to tell and departed in haste, anxious to share its sequel with an old crowd? 10. Coda. I was the child who enjoyed summer days on a California beach, who studied the pedigree of our beagle puppy, who created a relationship chart for our glass animal collection. I was the young woman who resonated to Mormon teachings on genealogy, who interviewed cousins at family picnics, who found my way to Europe to meet my great aunt when I was 21. I was the visitor to whom she gave her photographs, the master's candidate who wrote a thesis of poems about a search for roots. I was the doctoral student who framed prints of Monet's sailboats for my LA apartment, the beach lover who left California for a tenure-track job, the homeowner who rehung the sailboats in Salt Lake City. I am the dreamer whose sleep is broken by visions of catastrophic waves. And I am the woman who longs for North Friesland, who yearns in my high desert home for its sea-moistened air. I had thought to have children, especially a daughter, to tell the stories of a forgotten world. But I've taken no young pilgrims with me on my travels, waited without them in the wanted sea. My foster brother, Carl, shared Frisian heritage through ancestors from Friesland, the region of the Netherlands that colonized North Friesland's islands, marshes, and heath. So I shall pass what I can to his children, to my many cousins here and in North Friesland, and to you. In the long wake left by Edda, the evocative navigator and starting point for two diverging and converging limbs of family tree, their apex, their spitze, I ferry passengers between two shores. I am a ferryman's daughter.
Does this need to be clipped in?
No, I don't need it. If I don't speak too long. I just realized I missed all the slideshow because I was taking more notes. That's right. But I won't hear it as you speak. It was a...
And it actually went faster than it was supposed to. It was supposed to end right there.
But I can't imagine that the slideshow would have been much more than a distraction for me because I have... It's such a challenge to keep up with the scenes in terms of the language. I once told Doug Thayer that what most pissed me off about his writing was that it made me aware of the fact that I didn't have a past. And he says, "Well, everyone has a past." And I said, "No, you've got fields, and you went fishing, and had old trucks in the yard, and I grew up in Los Angeles. You know, it's like that. It's my past is not rich with that kind of natural metaphor that we're looking for all the time." And it occurred to me when I was first reading this, first of all, that I shouldn't have said yes to be the respondent. Because it was increasingly humiliating to read the prose. And the reason is that your memory, your remembering, even when you're not remembering, when you're inventing, when you're imagining, is better than my memory when I am remembering. As an evidence of that, I had decided that what I was going to do today was, rather than select the sections that I liked as I was reading them, I was going to select sections as I heard her reading them. Because when we met again the other day, and we've known each other for years and years, I asked her, I said, where did you ever learn that if you mixed ink with sea wormwood, it would keep mice away? Because in my crowd, that's not common knowledge. And you remember what you told me?
I think I've just been taking notes for a really long time. I've made a lot of trips, and the person who told me that knew that, so she worked with old records a lot.
Yeah,
her husband was an artist who worked with ink.
But you, and you said, well, I'm always talking to people. I'm always listening. I'm always getting information. Well, I talk to people too, but this just never comes up. You know?
Oh, I was searching about. I was looking for information about.
It doesn't matter. I could have been. I spent a whole year in the British Museum studying Lancelot Andrews. Didn't learn a thing. You know, not a thing. Didn't come away with anything that I could write about. I'm going to read you a couple of those lines that jumped out at me. Who would know that a slim blonde girl once sat spinning wool under the reed thatch of the ferryman's farmhouse, melted wax for candles in black clay pot from Jutland, or waded into the sea to step on smooth brown flatfish with red orange spots? Isn't that lovely?
Yeah.
And the reason it jumped out at me this time, because I had noticed it when I first read it, but I hadn't realized why, and it's that last part about her stepping on smooth brown flatfish. Because one of the stories I most remember from my youth is my father explaining to me why he hated frogs. And this came upon me, and this will charm you, this came upon me because on a family trip, my brothers and I walked down to this riverbed. It was all kind of stones and pebbles. And there were all these frog hatchlings that had just come out of their tadpole, and they were everywhere. There were literally thousands and thousands of frogs. The first thing that occurred to us, of course, was back in Los Angeles, where we used to go prowling the LA River, which is basically a sewer, it was hard to catch frogs.
There were lots of frogs.
There were lots of frogs in the LA River, but it was hard to catch them because it doesn't matter. And suddenly here were frogs you could scoop up by the handfuls. But our father hated frogs. And so we decided that it wouldn't be so bad if we each took a frog back, which was a very bad idea. So my father got us all in a row, and he said, I've told you I don't like frogs, that I have a thing about frogs, and yet you bring these frogs back. And I said, well, just one. And he said, well, but one is sufficient for you to bring back very bad memories to me. And I said, well, it was Vernon's idea. And then we looked down at Bryant, whom you know, and Bryant had his hands stuffed in his pockets. He was doing what Bryant often did, looking around like this. And my father looked at him and said, "What do you have in your pockets?" And Bryant, who at the time stuttered a little, said, and Dad said, "Don't say nothing." And so he stopped. And he said, "Take your hands out of your pockets." And Bryant said, "No." And he didn't say no to my father. And finally he did. And in each hand were crushed dozens and dozens of these little frogs. He hadn't listened about taking just one. I thought my father would thrash Bryant, but instead he sat us down and he told the story about how he would go fishing with his father at night fishing, and his father would go ahead with a flashlight, which meant that my dad couldn't see where he stepped, and he was always stepping on and squashing frogs. Now, that isn't in any way as pretty an image as this one, but the fact that this one could call back for me a memory that I had forgotten for a very long while, you know, it speaks to the richness of the prose and to additional detail, like two women selling butter and eggs. I don't know why that impresses me, but why butter and eggs? Why do they go together?
Those were two things that were sold in the market.
Yeah, butter and eggs. And somehow they just seemed to go together.
So they had chickens and cows.
And the other thing was, it's the first time anyone has talked about clogs in anything that I've read. My father came back from his mission in Denmark with these wooden shoes. And for the first time, I couldn't ever imagine, my brothers and I used to stumble around in them, but I could never imagine anyone actually wearing them. But they were worn by farmers.
They still are.
As they still are, and why?
If the fields are wet, it gives you protection, plus it's very warm. And
if a cow steps...
Oh, that's probably true, too.
Yeah. If a cow steps on a wooden shoe, it doesn't hurt nearly so much. The richness of this description is underscored by the changes that she made between the time that she gave me the draft and that she is now reading the draft. And I think you gave me two versions before we got here. And she didn't start giving me versions until like 36 hours ago or something. And so she's in the process of rewriting. And... years ago, I don't know how many of you remember the poet Mae Swenson, who was a wonderful poet and a Jack Mormon poet, which was part of my enthusiasm for that in her verse. And I discovered that her sister was the wife of the head of the music department at BYU, I think. He was a head of something. And so I tracked her down and told her how enthusiastic I was about Mae Swenson. And she said, "Oh, well, that's interesting." She said, "You know, I have some of her early poems." I said, "Well, I've read all of her poems. And she said, "Yes, but these are her handwritten drafts of those poems." So I was able to talk her out of them for a day, long enough to get them copied. And I wrote a paper going back and seeing the changes that she had made and inventing reasons why she had made them, probably not at all the right reasons. But it impressed on me that for the first time that one of the ways to discover really good writing is to see the ways in which good writing becomes better writing, if you have the patience for rewriting, which a good writer should have. And these changes are not are terrific because they're so small. I can see four thatched farmhouses linked to me through a complicated web of family ties. And that becomes, I can see three other thatched farmhouses. I suspect because you remembered you were coming out of one of them.
Well, it's because the one where my grandmother was born actually doesn't have a thatch roof, as I realize. It hasn't tiled. And it's not the same house, so there have been changes. But yeah, I was wrong.
You see, I would have maybe remembered that, and then I would have thought, nobody knows.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. The people there know. They know. I mean, this is not just for...
At Sunstone, they wouldn't have known. beneath me, in the tunnel below the dike, I picture tall oak gates that swing open when the tide streams out. And that becomes beneath me. Beneath me, I can't remember it exactly, but it's something like, beneath me, I see metal gates in the tunnel below the dike. So she's actually looking now and she's seeing these metal gates that, as she imagines them, are metamorphosed into tall oak gates. Well, in the original, she doesn't mention the gates that she was actually seeing. In the draft I first received, it just said, beneath me, in the tunnel below the dike, I pictured tall oak gates. And she went back and corrected it by letting the reader know why she was imagining oak gates. Now, it wasn't an invention, but rather it was a transition back in time. And then finally, because I've got questions more than comments that I want to ask, and one of those questions has to do with butterflies and silver. But the question of racial memory, or of cell memory, as you say, the Jewish... rabbi, who's the Jewish rabbi who wrote Me and Thou?
Buber.
Martin Buber.
Buber, thank you very much. Memory. Talked a lot about racial memory because of the, and he talked about it as a way of trying to instruct us of why Jews stay together, why Jews are together, and that there is a community that springs out of the individual. Not that the community imposes itself upon the individual, but that the individual seeks the community, and that without the community, we are in some way less. It's why so many of us come here instead of to church, still clinging to the community without which we feel less. There are problems with that, because if you take it just a little bit further, it becomes master race stuff. You know, it can be perverted into stuff that is very, very bad. But the good side of it, the bright, happy side of it, was recently underscored by the Dalai Lama when he was asked, what religion is it best for a person to have? And he said, the religion into which they were born. Now, part of that has to do with the Lama's trust in predestination and all of that stuff. But I think a part of it also has to do with this idea of whatever it is that we bring with us, which I think for Mormons is particularly important because of our theology about the preexistence, which is had by some parts of Judaism, not the one I'm most familiar with, but conservative and Orthodox Jews believe in a rich tradition that posits a pre-existent life. And so I think that part, which you get to at the end, is a really interesting note. And it so nicely makes sense out of your dreams and everything that you start us out with, that it's really satisfying. Now, I'm going to stop with my questions. And my questions are these. You have relatively little dialogue in this. And I sometimes get the sense that when you do have dialogue, it's really just as a kind of bridge to more narration, because the narration picks up rather quickly after that. And I'm sensitive to that because my short fiction, which I was smart enough to stop writing, was once criticized for this very fact, that I do a lot of talking about stuff and don't let other people talk enough themselves. Imagine that. And then finally, you have these two lines. And they're far apart. And I'm hoping you won't tell me, oh, that was an accident. And you say, two women selling butter and eggs. That's not it. That's the wrong kind of butter. Here we go. As I approach clumps of mothers and lambs lope off down the long slope into the nature sanctuary below, only an occasional white butterfly floats by, the purple thistles they love having recently been cut back. Now, later on, I may not have taken count of the other one, yes. Later on, you say, only an occasional white butterfly floats by, the purple thistles they love having recently, no, that's the same one. Later on, it becomes a blue butterfly, and you talk about the thistles. And I couldn't figure out why the repetition, and I would like you to begin your response to questions there.
Well, there are several kinds of butterflies. There's quite a few butterflies there. I think the slide showed at least three different kinds. The day that I was walking on the dike, and actually the day that I wrote about in the present tense, which was a week ago Wednesday, there were only white butterflies, and the thistles had all been cut back. But I had walked on that dike a number of other times, and maybe it's the particular time of year, but there can be beautiful blue butterflies. There were bumblebees. The white ones seemed to be really prevalent in the last month when I was there.
And how many kinds of butterflies were there? You said three?
The ones that I... that I'm aware of, there are three.
Yeah. That I wouldn't know that. Go ahead.
That's, and so it's supposed to be talking about my walking in the present tense. And when Etta's walking, there were blue ones.
Because I like
the blue ones best, so I put the blue ones there. Yeah.
And then dialogue. How do you use dialogue, and is it conscious or?
I could probably be more conscious. I'll take the criticism and look at it.
Oh, thank God there's something wrong with it.
Yes.
I don't know that there's something wrong with it. Just because a certain young person was criticized before doesn't mean that every writer who uses that approach is equally bad.
Well, if it was wrong with my prose, it's certainly wrong with hers.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Todd?
Gabriel Garcia Marquez often has, pages of narration and then one piece of dialogue. It's really striking.
Interesting. Well, I admit, I'm much bigger on description and setting in this piece than I am on dialogue. Yeah, you could have used that.
Yes, I could.
Yes,
Margaret. First of all, just thank you. That was so moving.
Very beautiful.
Thank you.
Very moving.
I appreciate that coming from you.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. But what I want to know is this a larger project? I mean, you sort of gave us... It felt there was a completeness with the section that you gave, and I wanted
That's
to know
good.
How you imagined the...
Well, I've been told recently that I need to put more of myself in it, so I'm backing up and doing more about why I'm there. So that's more traditional memoir. Mm-hmm. But I have a number of other ideas for other chapters and other essays.
In the past.
But what's it going to be when you're done?
I would like to think it will be a book. That's my goal.
Actually.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry.
It'll be a full-length movie.
Oh. Okay.
Do you put it in the category of personal history? Or?
Well, one of the problems that may be a problem, I don't know if it's a problem. I'm right now, what you got, I was mixing fiction that I imagined with real, and I've been told that that would be an editorial stumbling block. People would like it to be one or the other, but
right.
I think if I'm very, very clear, if I'm very clear about saying what I'm imagining and what I'm not, and very careful when I'm in the present tense about saying things like most probably they met in the Oatsden home, then that might still work. But getting it published when you're mixing the genres is more difficult.
Italics and
I don't know.
I tried that, and there were so many italics. You know,
that you didn't make it like, oh, I'm imagining this. Because for me, the way you framed it made it obvious that...
That's what I'm hoping.
That you were not...
Yeah.
You know, you don't know what happened back then. You had
Nobody
you made
does.
It very clear that there were only remnants of
well,
what
that's
you
good
knew.
Feedback because
yeah.
I would like to think that it's clear that this part
yeah,
is true and this
yeah.
part is
yeah,
imagined.
To me, that it would change.
No way
it would feel didactic and contrived.
Well, and good.
Do you agree with me?
Yeah, the part. That, yes, thank you very much. Although I do think there should be more dialogue.
We heard you.
The part that seemed to me most contrived and least natural, curiously, wasn't the stuff you were inventing.
Okay.
And it certainly wasn't the stuff that you were remembering, but it was your explanations. And, you know, I can imagine a kind of Moby Dick arrangement where instead of getting all that awful stuff about whaling, you know, instead you get these stories side by side, you know, a personal essay and the other fictional.
Mm-hmm.
And you might explain that in a foreword, mm-hmm. But I thought it was delightful, especially since you put the tail of the dog in its mouth so nicely with having that final image resolve.
Well, that's good feedback yeah. to have too. My dean is here, and thank you for coming. But she asked me when I came in here, I told her that just recently I found where the fairy house was, and she said, well, how did you find it? And I said, that's another story. Because I had recently changed a major section because I know where it was now, and I didn't. I had it very like, well, it could be here or here or here, and now I know. And that is another story of how I found it.
Hasn't there been a movie recently that jumps back and forth historically like that? It's nothing I would have gone to see. It's kind of one of these...
Oh, I know. It's the Woody Allen one.
Girly films.
It's the Woody Allen one.
Midnight in Paris. Yeah, okay. Oh, well, Midnight in Paris I will go see. But this is another thing which a person was... Well, they're living in a house, and then... They're sending letters back and forth.
Oh, that was a few years ago, and it was a bad movie. River, and with Sandra Bullock, and I don't remember the name. Yeah.
I wasn't suggesting you turn it into a bad movie. What I was suggesting is it seems to me that there is some precedence for the form.
Okay. I would like to think so, because I'm sort of doing it anyway, so.
Well, I think it's great if you invented a new form. Why not?
Okay.
Okay, we're actually out of time.
Todd,
did you have your hand up before?
Somebody
had a hand up.
So my questions are not literary at all. I want to understand a little bit more. Is this an area that there's been this constant struggle between the people and the sea? They'll
yes.
like something and
yes.
claim it, and
yes.
then the sea takes it back?
Absolutely. And even today, because the North Sea is rising, the area is threatened.
So they've taken it back, some of it.
Yes.
But do they take back all that was
No, they've made some strategic decisions about we'll take back this much and turn this into a nature sanctuary rather than farmland. And so they have sort of a master plan. I don't think there are plans right now to dike more. It's more just a matter of keeping the dikes
sound enough. Yeah,
they're going to
have a hard time.
Yeah.
They're going to have a really hard time this century. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
But what about these towns that vanished? Are those...
Oh, I walked on one of them. No, there are traces in the mudflats.
You can go out there and see.
Yeah, about 4 or 5 miles out.
Yeah. Ancestors lived and laughed.
I think all of them
died.
I think they don't have any descendants. I think all of them drowned.
No, they wouldn't have, because some of them would have married out and been out in other
That's
towns.
Possible. That's possible. Yes, that is possible.
I hate to cut it off, but we need to find the next group. Thank you very
Great
much.
Great questions. Thank you.
It's really good.
Yeah, I really like it.